Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Tallahassee, Florida is a city that comes alive with the energy of Florida State University. Tens of thousands of students flooding the streets. Football Saturdays that are celebrated more like holidays. And 9 months of the year buzzing with the pulse of a college town. But when the summer comes and the students leave, Tallahassee slows down and the city's beauty comes into focus. Rolling hills, crystal clear springs, and massive oak trees draped in Spanish moss. The kind of small-town southern charm that feels comforting, safe, even idyllic. But on July 18th, 2014, horror struck the city when FSU law professor Dan Markell was ambushed in his own driveway in broad daylight. This single act of violence would unravel family secrets, ignite conspiracies, and spark courtroom battles stretching more than a decade, all leading back to one unlikely figure, a doting grandmother, hundreds of miles away. But is it possible that behind the gentle image of a grandmother lurked the mind of a killer? The prosecution says she conspired a murder. The defense says she's simply an overbearing mother. But it's the jurors who have the final say. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is 13th Juror Podcast. Today's episode is Florida versus Donna Adelson, Part 1, The Prosecution's Case. Dan Markell grew up in Toronto in a close-knit Jewish family where faith, education, and community were at the center of daily life. From childhood, Dan was full of energy, always exploring and asking questions. That boundless curiosity, paired with a sharp mind, quickly set him apart. Dan excelled in school, and his passion for learning carried him across the globe. He studied politics and philosophy at Harvard, earned a master's in political theory at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Cambridge, and then he returned to Harvard for law school, where he graduated magna cum laude. After clerking for a federal judge and working at a law firm, he joined the faculty at Florida State University's College of Law. At FSU, Dan earned a reputation for brilliance, intensity, and high expectations. He challenged his students and left a lasting mark on nearly everyone who passed through his classroom. In February of 2006, Dan married his girlfriend of 3 years, Wendy Adelson. The couple met online in 2003 when Wendy was in her first year of law school. Wendy grew up in South Florida, where her close-knit family ran a successful dentistry practice. Her childhood was comfortable and secure, and at the center of it all was her mother, Donna. Donna was deeply involved in her children's lives and was determined to keep them close, both emotionally and geographically. In her mind, her hands-on approach has paid off. She raised a doctor, an oral surgeon, and now her youngest, Wendy, was becoming a lawyer and marrying a Harvard-educated law professor. On paper, Dan and Wendy looked like the perfect match, two ambitious legal minds united by career and faith. They welcomed their first son in 2009 and a second in 2010. What looked promising on paper soon showed cracks. Dan and Wendy clashed, and behind every disagreement loomed Donna, often weighing in on everything from where the couple should live to how their children should be raised. By 2012, the marriage had fully collapsed. That September, Dan returned home from a business trip to find Wendy gone, the children's clothes, toys, and furniture gone with her. And on the bed waiting for him were divorce papers. The split between Dan and Wendy quickly turned bitter as they argued over everything from finances to custody. Wendy wanted out of Tallahassee, She wanted to take the boys to Miami, where her family lived. But Dan fought back fiercely, arguing that moving them 500 miles away would effectively cut him out of their lives. Despite all his professional accolades, Dan's proudest accomplishment was fatherhood. He showed up at daycare to read with his sons, covered his office walls with their drawings, and filled his living room with their toys. He couldn't imagine life without them nearby, nor would he allow it. For Donna, however, Wendy's relocation was non-negotiable, just a problem to be solved. And in trying to solve it, she would expose just how deep her influence ran. Donna threw herself into her daughter's divorce, editing filings, drafting strategies, and even suggesting ways to pressure Dan into doing what they wanted. Even her own attorneys would later admit she was inserting herself too often. But the question that would come to define this case is this: how far was Donna Adelson willing to go to get what she wanted? By July of 2014, the divorce was final, but litigation over finances and custody dragged on. Still, Dan had settled into a new routine: teaching law, seeing someone new, and spending as much time as possible with his sons. The morning of July 18th began like so many others. Dan dropped his two young sons at daycare, hit the gym, then headed home. But what Dan didn't know was that as he drove through those quiet streets, he was being followed. Two men he had never met had traveled 500 miles to Tallahassee with one purpose: to end his life. Around 11 a.m., as Dan pulled into his driveway, the men followed close behind and then made their move. Two shots to the head. A neighbor heard the blast and looked out the window just in time to see a light-colored Prius back out of Dan's driveway and speed away. He went next door to check on Dan and found him slumped over in his car, covered in blood. Paramedics rushed him to the hospital, where doctors fought to save him, but his injuries were too severe. Dan Markell died at the age of 41. A brilliant scholar, a devoted father, executed in broad daylight. From the start, investigators knew this wasn't random. Nothing had been stolen. Dan's wallet was still in his car, cash inside. No fingerprints, no DNA, no shell casings. This wasn't a robbery gone wrong. It was an ambush, a professional hit. But why would someone be hunting a law professor? Detectives began with the neighbor's tip, the light-colored Prius, fleeing Dan's driveway. They pulled surveillance videos from around town, and there it was, a Prius matching that description, following Dan as he went to and from the gym and into Dan's neighborhood just before the shooting. Then came the break. Video footage from two city buses showed a SunPass transponder in the windshield of the Prius. For Tallahassee detectives, this was a bright red flag. SunPass is Florida's toll system, but toll roads are mostly in Central and South Florida, which signaled to detectives that maybe this car wasn't local. They combed through Department of Transportation and SunPass records and found precisely what they were looking for: a Prius that had conveniently left Miami the day before the murder, returned after, and was linked to a rental car company in North Miami. From there, the trail led straight to two names: Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera, childhood friends from Miami, both with long criminal histories. Investigators pulled phone records and GPS data that verified their trip to Tallahassee. And with that, they knew they had their guys. But the question that remained was, why? What was their connection to an FSU law professor hundreds of miles away? As detectives dug a little deeper, they found their answer. Investigators discovered a curious network of people linking Garcia and Rivera to the Adelson family. As it turns out, Sigfredo Garcia's ex-girlfriend, Katie McBanawa, was currently dating Wendy's older brother, Charlie. With that discovery, the investigation suddenly shifted into the orbit of the Adelson family. But was this the missing link, or just coincidence? For years, the answer to that question would hang in the air as trials for Dan's killers went forward and the Adelsons remained untouched. Luis Rivera, the getaway driver, cut a deal, telling investigators and jurors how it all unfolded. Two different trips from Miami to Tallahassee in a rental car, a slip of paper with Dan's photo and license plate number. Sigfredo Garcia pulling the trigger in Dan's garage. And afterward, cash delivered through Katie McBanawa, divided up as payment for murder. Lewis's testimony sealed the fate of his co-conspirators. Sigfredo Garcia was found guilty in 2019. Katie's first trial ended in a hung jury. But in 2022, she was retried and also convicted for Dan's murder. They were both sentenced to life without parole. For a moment, it looked like the story might end there. But there's a twist. In April 2022, just weeks before Katie's retrial, came an announcement that changed everything. Charlie Adelson had been arrested. Suddenly, the case shifted. And by the time Charlie went to trial in 2023, the state had a new weapon in their case against Charlie. Katie McBanawa herself. After years of denial, Katie finally admitted her role, which directly implicated Charlie. She told jurors that after Dan's murder, Charlie is the one who paid her the cash, which she then split with Sigfredo and Lewis. Her testimony matched what Lewis had told investigators, but it carried a weight that Lewis's never could. She wasn't just a co-conspirator. She was Charlie's girlfriend, the missing link that tied the Adelsons straight to the hitmen. It only took 3 hours for a jury to find Charlie guilty. And like Katie and Sigfredo, he was sentenced to life without parole. And all of that is where our story begins. Just 1 week after Charlie's conviction, the FBI made a fifth arrest. The woman prosecutors say was the mastermind behind it all, 73-year-old Donna Adelson. Everyone from defense to prosecution agrees on the bookends of this story. On one end, Donna's hand in her daughter's divorce was unmistakable. Her constant pressure, endless emails, and refusal to let go were evident. On the other, two hitmen from Miami ambushed Dan Markell in his driveway, then collected money for his murder, funneled through Katie McBanawa by Charlie Adelson. The real question lies in the space between. What happened in the months after Dan fought back against the relocation and before those shots were fired? According to prosecutors, Donna's role during that time went far beyond the works of a controlling mother. They say she wasn't just involved. She was the driving force, the mastermind, the one who turned a family feud into a murder plot. Now, more than a decade after Dan's murder, the matriarch at the center of it all would finally stand trial. The end of this tragic story would be decided by 12 strangers inside a Leon County courtroom. Their task? To decide whether Donna Adelson was merely connected or deeply complicit. Based on the testimony and evidence they presented, this is the prosecution's version of the story. On August 22, 2025, Assistant State Attorney Sarah Catherine Dugan rose to deliver the prosecution's opening statements. She told the jury, "This was an execution, a professional hit carried out by two men from Miami. But behind it all was the woman sitting right there at the defense table, Donna Adelson." According to prosecutors, Donna wasn't just a worried mother or doting grandmother. She was the relentless driving force behind her daughter's bitter divorce. Her anger toward Dan Markell had simmered for years, spilling out in emails, in legal filings, and in plan after plan to get her grandsons out of Tallahassee. Dugan told jurors that after every effort failed, Donna turned to the one person she believed could make it happen, her son, Charlie. Together, they set in motion a plan to make sure Dan Markell was removed from their lives forever. However, Dugan couldn't just claim Donna was the mastermind behind Dan Markell's murder without showing the jury she had the evidence to prove it. There was no single smoking gun in this case. So instead, the state built its case piece by piece using emails, phone calls, and receipts of carefully laid plans, which they argued pointed straight back to Donna Adelson. And it all began with motive. In December of 2012, Wendy was preparing to file the petition for relocation, asking the court for permission to move with the boys to Miami. She wanted out of Tallahassee, out of the marriage, out of the city. So she sent the draft petition to her mother with a short note. Here it is. Let's edit. Donna was more than willing to help. She wasn't just supportive of the move. She was invested in it. She had grown to despise Dan. She didn't like his strict religious practices or the way he insisted on raising the boys with them. She mocked him behind his back, calling him gibbers, which prosecutors argued was an anti-Semitic remark. Donna told Wendy she was smart to get rid of Dan. After all, he was holding her back. She even began mapping out Wendy's new life without Dan, sending her dating profiles of eligible men in Miami, reminders that a new life was there waiting on her as soon as the judge says go. But Dan wasn't going to let go of his children so easily. He fought the relocation and asked the judge to deny the request. To Donna, though, relocation wasn't a request. It was a demand, the one thing she called non-negotiable. It didn't matter what Donna thought, though, because in June of 2013, the judge agreed with Dan and denied relocation, with prejudice. The boys were legally required to live in Tallahassee for good. For Dan, it was a victory, a chance to remain a daily presence in his son's lives. For Wendy, it was disappointing. It left her feeling trapped in a city she didn't want to call home. But for Donna, it was unacceptable that the one non-negotiable she held onto in this divorce had been taken off the table indefinitely. Prosecutors told jurors Donna never accepted the relocation denial as final. Instead, she shifted gears. In the weeks that followed, Donna stopped consoling her daughter and started issuing instructions. She sent Wendy what she called a plan of action, a step-by-step strategy to make Dan's life miserable until he caved. And the instructions were extreme. The first step in Donna's scheme to force Dan into submission focused on weaponizing his Jewish heritage and utilizing his children as pawns. She told Wendy to register the boys for Christian Sunday school and to be sure to post a photo of the children in front of the church with the caption, "New Beginnings in Tallahassee." Donna knew that within minutes of Wendy posting, Dan would see the post or, at the very least, start getting phone calls about it. The next step? Find a Catholic tutor for the boys, a task Donna said she would happily arrange herself. Then Wendy was to tell Dan that the children will, in all caps, be baptized in the Catholic Church, and that as long as Dan forced Wendy to stay in Tallahassee, the Catholic Church would be a big part of their lives. This wasn't just idle venting. Donna was deliberately targeting Dan's identity as a devout Jewish father, turning his faith into a weapon against him. And it didn't stop there. One of the most shocking suggestions of all, Donna told Wendy to dress the boys in Hitler uniforms to push Dan over the edge. According to the prosecution, Donna's interference went far beyond anti-Semitism. She wasn't just advising. She was directing. She drafted motions for Wendy to file, compiled detailed logs of every trip that Dan took over 4 years, and argued that he was gone too often to be a present father. She insisted on reviewing every filing, sending back edits written in Wendy's voice, dictating exactly what her daughter should say. And when Wendy forwarded her a personal email from Dan, an email where he vulnerably reflected on his shortcomings as a husband, Donna pounced. She marked it up and sent it back with instructions. Use this against him in court. To her, it wasn't a moment of remorse from a husband at the end of his marriage. It was an admission, evidence to exploit. To prosecutors, this retaliation showed just how willing Donna was to weaponize even the most personal moments in pursuit of her goal. Again and again, her message was the same: control. take control from Dan, show him he hadn't won anything. When Wendy forwarded Dan's proposed divorce settlement, Donna's reply came back in all caps. The answer is no to all of this. She told Wendy to reject every offer, screw him financially, and never sign anything without her approval. Email after email was shown to the jury. The prosecution's point was clear. Donna's determination to bring her daughter and grandsons to Miami only intensified after the court shut the door. Every message, every tactic, making Dan miserable, using the children, leveraging religion, threatening his finances, it was all an effort to claw back control. Unfortunately for Donna, Dan was the one person she couldn't control. And the more evident that was, the more desperate her plots became. She even floated the idea of a $1 million bribe if Dan would just agree to let Wendy move south. Wendy and her children's relocation became Donna's mission, and she was going to do whatever it took to get her way. The only obstacle preventing her from winning was Dan Markell. After her many failed attempts, Donna turned to the one person she believed could make the impossible happen, her son, Charlie Adelson. According to prosecutors, that's when the family feud took a dark turn. What began as a controlling mother's obsession would evolve into conspiracy, pulling in Charlie, his girlfriend, and two men willing to kill for cash. Like many siblings, Charlie Adelson wasn't deeply involved in his sister's private life. Sure, they were close, but Charlie's world revolved around fast cars, boats, and women, not custody battles and court filings. But Donna never let Charlie forget about what she called the problem, Wendy's divorce with Dan. Through emails, calls, and constant pressure, Donna relied on Charlie to step in her mind, make things right. Like the time Wendy almost bought a house in Tallahassee. In October 2013, after Wendy's relocation had been denied, Wendy decided it was time to plant roots in Tallahassee. So she put in an offer on a home. Donna, however, hated the idea and wanted it stopped immediately. She complained to Charlie, and he said he'd have it taken care of. And he did. On Halloween Day, Wendy abruptly canceled the deal. When Charlie passed the news along, Donna was thrilled. She called him a miracle worker. She even asked, "How'd you do that?" It became a pattern. Donna pushed, Charlie fixed. Donna wanted, Charlie delivered. But the problem of Dan Markell was bigger than a house in Tallahassee. And this, prosecutors argued, was when Charlie's role as the fixer took a turn for the worse. Charlie had been hearing all about it for months. Donna flooded his inbox with complaints, how the custody battle was tearing Wendy apart, how the stress was raising her husband Harvey's blood pressure, and how constant trips to Tallahassee were draining the family's business. In Donna's eyes, their entire family was suffering because of one man, Dan Markell. And she needed this problem fixed, permanently. Charlie knew what needed to be done, but he was a smart guy, so he surely wasn't going to get his own hands dirty. If this plan was going to move forward, he needed someone else to make the connection. And he knew exactly who to ask. Enter Katie McBanois. Katie was Charlie's girlfriend at the time, but she was also still tied to her ex, Sigfredo Garcia, the father of her two kids. Katie had mentioned Sigfredo's long and violent rap sheet to Charlie before. And for Charlie, that detail sparked an idea. On Halloween night, he and Katie were at a party when he decided to ask her the question that would change everything. Do you know anyone who could hurt somebody? Katie knew exactly what he meant. That one whispered question was the spark that prosecutors say ignited the conspiracy. They both knew what needed to happen. It was just a matter of when. For Donna, it couldn't come soon enough. Dan Markell continued to be a thorn in her side, dragging them back into court again and again. He filed a motion for sanctions against Wendy, accusing her of hiding assets. He filed another to block Donna from unsupervised visits after the boys told him, "Grandma says you're stupid and Grandma hates you." Every new filing meant another round of texts and emails to Charlie. Donna complained about Wendy's legal fees, about Dan showing up at a soccer game on Wendy's custody day, even about how she couldn't get a protective order against Dan for Wendy because there had been no threats and no abuse. Through it all, she and Charlie painted Wendy as the victim, fragile, stressed, and in need of protection. By March of 2014, plans were being made. Katie brought in her ex, Sigfredo Garcia, who in turn brought in his childhood friend, Luis Rivera. From there, the roles fell into place. Charlie would deliver the money. Katie would serve as the go-between. Sigfredo would pull the trigger, and Luis would drive the car. It was no longer just theory. Now, it was a plan. One Charlie and Donna began discussing in code. In early March 2014, Donna and Harvey were driving back from Tallahassee when she texted Charlie. She told him she couldn't talk at the moment, but when they stopped, she'd duck into a bathroom so she could talk to him in private. She said to pick up when she calls because she'll have very limited time alone. And at the end, she wrote, "Erase this text after you read it." 20 minutes later, another message followed. She'd be calling in a few minutes to talk about Dad's birthday gift. She said she had some good ideas, followed by a winky face emoji. In that second message, though, there was no instruction to delete. So why the secrecy? Why would Donna need to duck into a bathroom to talk about a gift when Harvey's birthday was still 4 months away? Why tell Charlie to delete the first message, the one about needing privacy, and then send another mentioning a birthday gift? Both Wendy and her brother, Rob, confirmed on the stand that Harvey never received a birthday gift that year. In fact, Rob recalled Donna saying Harvey didn't even want one, that being at the party was gift enough. To the state, the meaning was clear. Harvey's birthday gift wasn't about a gift at all. It was code for the hit on Dan Markell. With the plan in motion, prosecutors say Donna started preparing for Wendy's relocation by quietly purchasing a condo in Miami. On the paperwork, Donna and Harvey listed Wendy, who was still bound to Tallahassee, as a resident. It was a ready-made landing spot, waiting for Wendy and the boys the moment the obstacle of Dan was out of the way. Then it seemed like Donna began erasing Dan from the children's lives. On the invite to Harvey's birthday party, she listed their last name as Adelson instead of Markell, as if he were already gone. And as the Adelsons made their preparations, people around Wendy began noticing strange behavior. Her new boyfriend, Jeff Lacasse, told jurors that the family seemed consumed by their anger toward Dan. He remembered Charlie joking about hiring a hitman as a divorce present for Wendy, but laughed that a TV was cheaper. Charlie bragged about knowing people on both sides of the tracks, including the criminal world. But at the time, Jeff brushed it off as bravado. Soon after, the talk of a hitman came up again, this time not as a joke. Jeff testified that just before Dan's murder, Wendy told him relocation could only happen if something happened to Danny. Then she said Charlie had looked into all options to take care of the Dan problem, including a hitman, and even mentioned a price, $15,000. Despite Wendy's odd behavior in those weeks, Jeff still didn't believe the hit was legit. One night in early June, he said Wendy was a nervous, anxious wreck. What Jeff didn't know then was that the same night he noticed Wendy's odd behavior, Donna had received word that the hitmen from Miami had rented a car and were on their way to Tallahassee. Looking back, Jeff would wonder if that was the real reason behind Wendy's panic, because she already knew what was in motion. The next morning, on June 5th, the hitmen promptly located Dan's house. However, According to Luis Rivera's testimony, when they found Dan, he had the boys with him. They weren't going to kill him in front of his kids, so they pulled back. They tailed him for a while, lost him, and eventually gave up. By June 6, they were back in Miami, and their first attempt to murder Dan Markell was a failure. The very next day, Charlie texted his mother, still working on Dad's B-Day present. Donna said she knew it was a tough one, but she reassured Charlie, saying, "I know you'll come through." For prosecutors, it was the clearest signal yet. Dad's birthday present, once again, wasn't about Harvey. It was code. The first attempt had failed, but Donna was confident that Charlie would deliver. From there, the odd behavior only intensified. And again, one date surfaced, July 18th. Wendy canceled a trip with Jeff Lacasse, insisting she had to be back that day, though their plans ended on the 17th. In Miami, she texted Dan to confirm that he'd be home on the 14th through the 18th, dates already settled in writing. And days before the murder, she pressed Jeff about his own trip on the 18th. What route was he taking? What time? What if he didn't go? Meanwhile, Donna was making preparations of her own. She scheduled a TV repairman to come to Wendy's house on July 18th. An odd move, since Jeff had seen the screen a month earlier, shattered as if someone had punched it. Wendy still insisted they watch movies on that broken TV, even as her boys complained they couldn't see. Prosecutors argued the broken TV, the same one Charlie once joked was cheaper than a hitman, was really just an alibi in disguise. As the 18th drew closer, the money began to move. Katie McBanwell later testified that on July 14th, she met Charlie for dinner, where he handed her cash that she then passed along to Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera, funds for the trip north. The rest would come after the job was done. From there, the plan went into motion. Katie told Charlie they got the rental car. Charlie called Donna on the landline to let her know. And on July 17th, Sigfredo and Luis headed for Tallahassee, this time determined to finish what they'd started. The next morning, July 18th, they followed Dan Markell home. As he pulled into his driveway, Sigfredo got out, walked up, and fired two shots into Dan's head before jumping back into the Prius. On the way back south, they tossed the gun off a bridge. Then Sigfredo called Katie with the message she was waiting for. It was done. Eventually, police were able to identify Luis Rivera as the driver, Sigfredo Garcia as the trigger man, and his ex-girlfriend, Katie McBanwell, as the go-between. Their involvement, however, was only part of the story. The bigger question, one that lingered for years, wasn't who pulled the trigger. It was who made it happen. Who gave the orders? Who paid for it and why? To answer that, investigators had to look beyond the hitman. They knew there was a connection to the Adelson family. Now they had to prove it. And as they pieced together the money trail, the wiretaps, and the coded conversations, the picture came into focus. This wasn't just a murder for hire. According to prosecutors, it was a family conspiracy. The hitmen may have pulled the trigger, but the Adelsons pulled the strings. And the prosecution walked jurors through every piece of evidence they said proved it, starting with the money. Luis Rivera testified the deal was simple. $100,000 to make Dan Markell disappear. He and Sigfredo would split most of it, funneled through Katie McBanwell, who was dating Charlie at the time. Katie kept her cut and passed the rest along. And where did the money come from? Charlie, the dentist, the fixer. Prosecutors claimed Charlie wasn't paying out of pocket, though. They argued that the cash came straight from his parents, Donna and Harvey. Katie told jurors that the night of the murder, she stayed at Charlie's house. And when she arrived, he said his parents had just been there, dropping off the money. Investigators backed this up with cell phone data showing Donna traveling north toward Charlie's house that night, plus a single text to her son. I'm outside. The timestamp lined up exactly with Katie's story. And the money trail didn't stop there. A forensic accountant testified that 44 checks from the Adelson Institute had gone to Katie McBanawa. Every one of them, handwritten and signed by Donna Adelson. The problem? Katie never worked there. Katie McBanawa didn't just testify about money changing hands. She told jurors what life was like with Charlie before the murder and how Donna's presence was always in the background. She described the night at the Halloween party when Charlie first asked her if she knew anyone that could hurt somebody and how the conspiracy developed from there. She described times they were discussing the plans when Charlie kept stepping out of the room to talk to Donna and then coming back in. To Katie, it was clear. Donna wasn't just aware, she was involved. She was pushing, questioning, and pressuring. Her voice echoed through Charlie, like a constant reminder that the job wasn't finished until every loose end was tied up. For prosecutors, that was the point. Donna didn't need to be the one directly handing over cash or calling the hitmen. She was the force behind it all, working through her son, keeping the pressure on, making sure the plan stayed alive. As powerful as Katie's testimony was, some of the most damaging evidence against Donna didn't come from her. It came later, after what investigators called the bump. In April 2016, nearly 2 years after Dan Markell's murder and before any arrest had been made, the FBI decided to act. They had wiretaps on Charlie and Katie, but time was working against them. They needed a spark, something to get the conspirators talking again. So they staged one. On April 20th, outside of Donna Adelson's Miami condo, an undercover agent approached her with a printout referencing Dan Markell's murder, with $5,000 and a phone number scrawled across it. It looked like blackmail. In reality, it was bait. And it worked. Within minutes, Donna was on a wiretap phone call with Charlie, where she uttered a statement prosecutors would not let the jury forget. It involves the both of us. To the state, those words were everything. Donna didn't think this was just Charlie's problem, or just Katie's or Wendy's. She knew it was hers too. On that same call, Donna carefully avoided saying anything outright, while Charlie kept pressing her for details. He asked her to send a picture of the flyer. She refused. This raised a question to the prosecution. If she had nothing to hide, why not just send the photo? Instead, Donna again slipped into code. She referenced the handwritten note on the flyer and told Charlie, "This TV was probably about five." And prosecutors said jurors didn't have to guess what that meant because Charlie decoded it in real time. His response, "They asked you for $5,000? After Donna's call, Charlie went straight to Katie. The FBI followed, recording the now infamous Dolce Vita meeting. In the noisy Miami restaurant, Charlie was caught talking openly about the murder, how police couldn't tie anything back to them, how if they had evidence, he'd be at the airport already. The meaning was clear. They weren't innocent people blindsided by suspicion. They were insiders, strategizing about how to keep the truth buried. The state piled on more. Jurors listened to hours of wiretaps. Donna with Charlie, Charlie with Katie, Katie with Sigfredo, code words, paranoia, cover stories. Over and over, the Adelsons circled the same themes. Who is blackmailing them, the cost of fixing it, and the fear of getting caught. For years, the case was built piece by piece. The Dolce Vita recording was almost too garbled to use because of how loud it was in the restaurant, until 2022, audio experts enhanced it, giving prosecutors what they needed to finally bring Charlie down. Charlie went on trial in October 2023. 9 years after first approaching Katie with that fateful Halloween question, do you know anyone who can hurt somebody? A jury convicted him in about 3 hours. Life in prison, no parole. And the very next day, Donna panicked. She picked up her phone and sent a text to Wendy saying, "You know I'm next, but I'm not going to let that happen." Then she texted her friend Anne to come over, but refused to explain why. And then she took a call from her newly imprisoned son, Charlie. Unbeknownst to Donna, Charlie's connection dropped, but the recorder kept rolling. Jurors heard Donna's voice complaining about Wendy, worrying over getting things in order, even admitting she had thought of hurting herself. But then she said something else. Donna talked about passports, travel, and how she had Googled non-extradition countries. Her own voice was telling jurors what she had in mind. Donna was planning on fleeing the country. She said she might get stopped at the airport, but it's worth a try. And less than a week later, she did try. On November 13, 2023, 1 week after Charlie's conviction, Donna and Harvey arrived at Miami International Airport with one-way tickets to Vietnam. She had luggage, she had a ticket, and she had no return flight booked. At the gate, federal agents closed in. After almost a decade, Donna Adelson was arrested and charged with the murder of Dan Markell. But one thing about Donna, she's going to try to control a situation. While in jail, she didn't just maintain her innocence, she tried to manufacture it. Two fellow inmates testified that Donna approached them with a plan. They were supposed to claim that Katie McBanawah had lied on the stand and that Donna had nothing to do with the conspiracy. She even wrote out a script for one of them to memorize. The woman was supposed to copy it in her own handwriting, then give the original back to Donna. The informants told the jury that they were offered money, land, even veneers from Harvey in exchange for their testimony. To the prosecution, it was as revealing as any wiretap. It showed a woman not only entangled in the murder-for-hire plot, but still, years later, trying to orchestrate her way out of it. The same way she had tried to orchestrate Charlie's moves, Wendy's life, and Dan Markell's death. After dozens of witnesses, hours of wiretaps, and stacks of exhibits, the prosecution had one final chance to pull it all together. They began where the story always began, with Dan Markell. Dan wasn't just a Harvard-educated law professor. He wasn't just a prolific scholar or a mentor in the classroom. He was a father. His days were arranged around drop-offs, pickups, and bedtime stories. Dan fought for the most important role in his life, fatherhood. And it was that fight, his refusal to let Wendy take the children 500 miles south to Miami, that cost him his life. All because no one wanted his family relocated more than Donna Adelson. Every email, phone call, wiretap, and money trail led investigators directly back to her. Prosecutor Georgia Kaplman told jurors, "There's not a smoking gun, because Donna was too smart for that. But she made mistakes." And that's what all of those exhibits are, mistakes. Prosecutors argue that Donna decided what was best for everyone, where Wendy should live, how Dan's children should be raised, and everything in between. In fact, this entire story is defined by one theme for Donna Adelson. The end justified the means. Collateral damage didn't matter. As long as Donna got what she wanted, nothing else mattered. On the outside, she may look like an innocent grandmother, but prosecutors told the jury, the evidence has revealed what she really is. Now, as far as the prosecution was concerned, Donna Adelson wasn't just a meddler. She was a mastermind, a grandmother whose obsession drove her to orchestrate a murder-for-hire plot that left Dan Markell dead and five people behind bars. But a trial is never just one version of the story. And the defense painted an entirely different picture when they gave their version of events. One where Donna wasn't a puppet master at all. She was just a mother with strong opinions. Sure, she used some harsh words when discussing her former son-in-law, but that's not a crime. She may be guilty of meddling, but this sweet woman could never conspire to commit murder. In fact, the defense says the real pressure came not from Donna, but from the very people already convicted. Criminals who saw the Adelsons as a payday. To the defense, Donna wasn't plotting. She was paying. Signing checks she was told to sign. Following instructions from her son, Charlie, who claimed the family was being extorted. So which was it? A mob-like family conspiracy or a family desperate to be free from extortion? Next time, we'll step into the defense's story, where Donna Adelson isn't the mastermind. She's the mark.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.